The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for April the 21st. Coming up on this week's podcast...
Just being singled out in that way led to all kinds of problems. You know, everything from very serious bombs delivered to my home, bricks through the windows, paint stripper on the cars, I mean, all this kind of stuff, demonstrations outside our house, just on and on and on for 10 years.
Colin Blakemore, the former head of the Medical Research Council, tells us about life as the bête noire for the animal rights lobby. Also in the show...
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
We reveal research that shows McEnroe's centre court tantrums might have been justified after all. And...
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
We discover the links between testosterone and money-making. Lunch is for wimps, but this is Science Weekly from The Guardian. No sooner had I proclaimed that we were back to full strength... then I'm all on my lonesome again in the pod this week. Not to worry, I like to think that the Science Weekly squad are here with me in spirit, if not in actual bodily form. Besides, dear listeners, a bit of podcasting jiggery-pokery will ensure that mine isn't the only voice you'll hear in the next half hour. Now, before we go any further, I want to tell you something that's got me particularly excited this week. Every day from the coming Saturday, The Guardian is giving out a free science course with the newspaper. Yes, I know that some other newspaper did something similar last week, but frankly, it was our idea first, and we got loads more pictures and better graphics and more Nobel Prize winners, so there. Anyway, the booklets cover everything you could possibly want to know about the Earth, the universe, physics, chemistry, biology, and we're going to scatter some of the highlights throughout the show. Here's your first glimpse now.
In the 1960s, the ultimate origin of the universe was regarded as lying beyond the scope of science altogether. But today, there are many attempts to explain it using physical theory, most often by appealing to quantum processes. If the Big Bang was indeed a natural event, then presumably nothing could prevent it from happening more than once. This suggests there may be many Big Bangs scattered throughout space and time, each producing an expanding universe of some sort. Possibly the entire assemblage of universes, often dubbed the multiverse, is eternal, even though each individual universe undergoes a life cycle of birth, evolution, and perhaps death. Everyone agrees, however, that many of the deepest questions about our cosmic origins cannot be answered within the framework of existing physical theory. Hopes are pinned on a final unified theory that will merge all of physics into a single super law. Only then might we be able to answer the most fundamental question of all, why there is something rather than nothing.
That's Science Weekly's Nell Bowes with physicist Paul Davis's thoughts on where the universe comes from. That's in part one of the guides.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
OK, well, let's get going this week. Professor Colin Blakemore has been described as one of the most powerful scientists in the UK. He's published more than 200 scientific papers and books focusing on his research in vision, brain development and conditions such as Alzheimer's disease and Huntington's. Recently, he's stepped down as the chief executive of the British Medical Research Council, a position he's held since 2003. For much of his career, Professor Blakemore's been outspoken on the issue of using animals in research and the need to carry out such experiments to develop new medicines and pursue knowledge. As a result, he's become a hate figure for the animal rights lobby and a target for much vitriol, physical and otherwise, from protesters, particularly in the last years of the 1980s. Science Weekly's James Randerson asked him to describe his experiences during that time.
I mean, what forced me, as it were, into that limelight was finding myself singled out for a campaign. 1987, I was targeted. And certainly since then, I've been very, very much involved. And I think in some respects, being targeted in that way was useful because it really made me think very, very deeply about how certain I was of my own position, my own philosophical position, the rights and wrongs. Just being singled out in that way led to all kinds of problems, you know, everything from very serious bombs delivered to my home. I mean, one that would certainly have killed if it had been opened, and it wasn't, fortunately. Two, the constant kind of drip-drip of threatening phone calls and letters, bricks through the windows, paint stripper on the cars. I mean, all this kind of stuff, demonstrations outside our house, just on and on and on for 10 years.
Has that now sort of stopped entirely, or does it still occasionally happen?
You know, I'm touching every bit of wood that's within sight, you know. It did stop 5 or 6 years ago. Can I use this opportunity to say I don't work on animals anymore? I haven't for 5 years. I don't have a Home Office license. That doesn't mean that I don't believe completely in the importance of this area of research, but I'm not involved in it myself, so I hope I won't be targeted again.
Have you ever, you know, actually met some protesters who've perhaps gone to those sorts of lengths and ever talked to them? I mean, what do you think about them?
I have. You know, I think I spend a lot of time talking, and not just talking to the press and trying to propagandise about the issue. But
I remember you saying one time that you spent 90% of your, one period, you were spending 90% of your time on this issue.
Well, it depends what you mean by period. I mean, there were certainly weeks when I spent every waking hour on the issue. But I think there were big chunks of my life where I was spending at least a quarter of my time on this issue. But yeah, I mean, I'm a great believer in dialogue. In debate, in trying to find consensus, or at least to nail down what are the bases for differences of opinion. So I've stood outside my house talking endlessly to protesters, and I've also been in touch with some of the more extreme end of the activist range. I mean, I think that I honestly believe that there are some individuals whose commitment to the cause goes beyond rationality, and that's deeply worrying when. It is difficult to engage in a discussion about why a person has a particular position and how one can try to resolve the differences between their views and other people's views, especially if it drives them to believe that the democratic process can't accommodate their position. And that's certainly where some of the extremists are.
My impression over the last couple of years is that there's been a real shift that's happened in both public attitudes, perhaps partly sparked by the protest group in Oxford of Laurie Pycroft and some of the students there, but also there's been a very effective police response which has managed to put away some of the nastier characters here. How do you sort of view the change that's happened over the last couple of years?
Well, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, judged by almost any metric, the change has been absolutely extraordinary. You know, the most quoted one is just the public opinion polls. 90% of the public, and this is proper Mori polls, with pretty sort of neutral questions. 90% of the public are now so-called qualified supporters. That is, they say, yes, I agree that animals can be used in research if it's for, an important cause, if suffering is minimized, and if there's no alternative. But if you add together those three groups, you get 90% of the public. Which is absolutely astounding. I mean, I can't think of any other so-called controversial topic on which 90% of the public have the same opinion. It's not controversial anymore, is it? I would describe that to three things. One, you're quite right. I mean, the government attitude, the new regulations, the increased policing attitude of the Crown Prosecution Service and the courts, and putting the real hardline people behind bars. Secondly, the media. The difference in the view of the media is fantastic. I mean, you just don't see the shock, horror, terrible animal torture stories that used to be, good headline stuff a few years ago. It's much, much more balanced. But third and most important, the research community, the researchers themselves have just become so much more open. I mean, there was a time 15 years, 10 years ago where there were two or three of us, myself included, who were willing to say anything about this issue. And now there are hundreds. That's really good. If we really believe in what we're doing, we've got to be capable of talking about it. But of course, people were scared to talk about it. So the removal of the real terrorist fringe has been very beneficial in opening up the debate.
And now that sort of threat of violence has subsided so much, are there things now happening behind the scenes? Is there more debate going on with those on the animal rights side of things who are more moderate and don't blow people up?
I hope that will happen. I mean, one of the things that I tried to do at a relatively early stage in my own personal experience, 1992, I set up with the leader of an animal rights group from Edinburgh, set up a forum for completely open, unconstrained debate. Anyone could come to the table, and it still operates. It's called the Boyd Group, and it's got the RSPCA, and it's got the Royal Society and the Royal Colleges and the MRC and all of these sorts of bodies. There's a singular lack of animal rights organisations. BUAV, Animal Aid, wouldn't come to the table. And that has emasculated, I think, that discussion. I hope that we can move on now in the new era to really having a proper medium for debate, more nuanced discussion. I mean, and I would say, by the way, this criticism of position does apply as much to the research community as to the opposition. The research community has been driven into as polarised a position as the extremists and has, I think, too much exaggerated its position. Overemphasized the benefits, downplayed some aspects of the suffering. And we need to open up the discussion about those things.
Colin Blakemore there. We'll have more of that interview later in the show. And if you want to listen to the full half-hour conversation, we've put it up on the site as this week's Science Extra. Head to guardian.co.uk/science for more. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come.
It's the middle stuff that we can't do yet. We can do various steps of it, but we can't get all the way from a stem cell to an egg or a sperm.
We discuss the ethics of making artificial sperm and eggs from stem cells. Plus, more facts and figures and general enlightenment from The Guardian's science course. That's all ahead, but first, here are some of the other science stories that have been making headlines over the past 7 days. Producer Ben's going to join me with your news jam.
News jam.
Vitamin supplements taken by millions of people do not increase life expectancy and may raise the risk of a premature death. That's according to a review of 67 studies with more than 230,000 subjects. When the best quality studies were analysed, vitamin A was linked to a 16% increased risk of dying, beta-carotene to a 7% increased risk, and vitamin E to a 4% increased risk.
The era of mass genome sequencing to assess risks of genetic disease has come a step closer with the publication of the genome sequence of scientist James Watson. The feat cost $1 million and took just 2 months to complete, and scientists are now predicting that the milestone of the $1,000 genome will be reached in just 6 years.
Money doesn't make the world go round. In fact, it's testosterone. And the more that city traders have, the richer they'll become, but only up to a point. Research on traders in a London city bank found that the Gordon Gecko types with the most testosterone in their system in the morning made most money during the day. But the researchers say that having too much prompts traders to take excessive risks.
And finally, research on professional tennis matches has found that when players make a formal challenge to a line call, judges are incorrect nearly 40% of the time. The hardest balls to get right are those that bounce on the baseline or the service line. Perhaps John McEnroe's centre court tantrums were justified after all. Well, I'm delighted to say that by the wonders of podcasting, James Randerson has appeared from the ether and joins me live-ish in the pod. James, thanks for coming in.
Great pleasure.
Tell us a bit more about the vitamins story. We've got a few things we were discussing on the desk about this a few days ago. Let's just lay it out. This study published in the Cochrane Review. First of all, what's the Cochrane Review? And tell us what it said.
Okay, the Cochrane Reviews are... very well established, very well conducted, highly sort of peer-reviewed pieces of science where they bring together loads of studies and try and kind of produce a consensus position on what do we really know about whatever it is they might be looking into. And in this case, they whittled down over 800 studies on antioxidant supplements like vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin E, that kind of thing. And they whittled it down to just 67 studies, which they thought were done in the best way. And what they were looking for was randomized clinical trials, which is where you give people either the supplement or a placebo and you look at an outcome. And specifically, they were looking at, do these things prolong your life? And they found that actually, no, they don't. And in three cases, vitamin A, vitamin E, and beta-carotene, those people in the trials who took the supplements died sooner than the ones who didn't, suggesting that the supplements are actually worse for you.
You see, now that sounds very counterintuitive. And if you're taking vitamins and minerals, and you would assume that, you know, as long as you're healthy and everything, that these things are going to be good for you. How have the vitamin pill manufacturers, for example, reacted to this?
They haven't exactly welcomed the study with open arms, should we put it that way. In fact,
they're criticising it for being...
They've criticized
biased
it for,
or what?
Well, all sorts of angles, but I mean, some of them pretty spurious. For example, I mean, some comments out there are sort of saying, well, this study only includes 8% of the studies that are out there, so how can it be an authoritative review of the evidence? Well, the reason it includes 8% is because they went through and whittled out all the useless studies and kept the ones which had the best methodology. So that criticism really isn't valid. And one has to bear in mind, I mean, you know, quite often we have a view that there might be a sort of a general feeling that people who make health foods and vitamins are nice and fluffy and cuddly, and doubtless some of them are, yeah, but also they're not just any businesses. I mean, the vitamin manufacturers are people like Roche, who are a large pharmaceutical company, That doesn't necessarily make them evil and bad, but they're not, you know, someone in their back garden, in their shed, manufacturing health food.
Sarah Bosley, our health editor, mentioned to us on the desk the other day that all of these major drug companies had been fined millions and millions of dollars in the early 90s for having a cartel.
In the late 90s, artificially
inflating the prices.
Roche was one of them. There were other companies in that list, so it's not just Roche.
These guys are not cuddly people who's giving you vitamin A and vitamin B and stuff. They're making money out of this. I mean, you know, good luck to them, but you know, you should take their advice on merit, really.
But the other thing that's interesting about the way this was reported, and I think it was sort of reported badly in some ways by the media, because you know, in the name of sort of journalistic balance, people would kind of add in the quote from, you know, the drug company or the person who's peddling vitamins, as if it was just an unbiased piece of information, rather than giving people, okay, this is sort of a massive study that's been peer-reviewed and that has reviewed all of the evidence in the field, and this is someone with an axe to grind who makes money out of this stuff saying, we don't think the evidence is right. And they didn't really make that clear. You know, the two were sort of presented together in some reports as if to say, well, go on, reader, you make up your own mind.
In some ways, that's worse than no information at all, isn't it? I mean, you'd never find that in a politics story, would you? You'd always have someone saying, well, that guy has that interest and this guy has that interest.
And I've even heard it sort of presented as, you know, quotes, the latest health scare, as if supplements are now the latest health scare, like all the other health scares you've heard about in the past. You know, this story really is different because of the way it's been done, I think.
So it's not a health scare, it's actually it's not a scare at all. It's a health warning, I suppose, from many, many, many scientists and many, many studies.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on from that to another study done early last week on testosterone. As a man made of testosterone, James, this is probably your story.
This pod is fueled by testosterone.
Well, most of the time.
the story, I really like this story, actually. I think it was interesting. It was an interesting piece of work. I spoke to the guy, he's a scientist, it was two scientists at Cambridge, but I spoke to a guy called John Coates who used to manage a trading floor on Wall Street with Deutsche Bank. So he kind of knows the background here. But now he's an academic, and perhaps because he had some access to that world, he went onto a City of London trading floor. He wouldn't tell me which one, unfortunately, but anyway. And he recruited a handful of the traders there, and he asked them to give him hormone tests in the morning for testosterone and cortisol. And then he tried to correlate the results of these with how they did during the day. And the interesting thing is that the higher your testosterone in the morning, the more money you're going to make during the day. It's a bit like at The Guardian. The more testosterone I have in the morning, the more words I write and the more hits I get on my stories.
The thing is this surprising though? I mean, more aggression is something you associate with the city. You know, these guys are kind of silverback types, alpha males, all of that.
It does fall into the kind of Gordon Gekko Wall Street stereotype very much. And in one sense, perhaps it's not that surprising, although it does seem, you know, you'd imagine that in the highly technical world of the city, that just the level of your hormone in a particular hormone in the morning would, you know, there'd be more to it than that. But I'm sure there is to a certain degree. But it is interesting that you can see a pattern.
Kind of understand, I guess, when city traders say they burn out at a certain age, because if you can't possibly have this much testosterone going on your whole life.
What he said he didn't want people to sort of walk away with was just the impression that the more testosterone you had, the more money you'd make, and therefore, you know, you'd get traders going in and bulking up with anabolic steroids or something in order to try and make more money. He reckons you get to a point where you keep doing well. By doing well, you get a testosterone boost. That gives you a boost the next morning, and that leads you to doing well. This is something called the winner effect that you see in sports like sprinting and also in animal contests between males. So he thinks that's all going on. But then you get to a stage where you've got so much testosterone going on that you start taking insane risks and you stop, you know, you stop really thinking rationally. And that's when these kind of crazy bubbles happen. So he thinks that, you know, the sort of instability of the market and the way that you get these irrational hikes in price are all to do with this sort of this testosterone effect.
Anyway, from one testosterone-fueled person to another, John McEnroe was featured in a lot of stories this week. Something about how line judges aren't necessarily right, or are they? I was confused by the coverage of this story, frankly.
Yeah, it was a gift to science journalists, but it was interesting how we all went sort of different ways on it. Our colleague on The Times reported it as if John McEnroe, this is proof that John McEnroe was wrong. And my story was, this is proof that John McEnroe was right. So make of that what you will. The story, what they actually did was take line call challenges from ATP, you know, professional tennis tournaments, and analyse how often was the official wrong and how often were they right. And when they were right and wrong, how far away was the ball from the line. And when these challenges are made by players, incidentally, the rules now say that a player can make a challenge twice during any given set. And when that happens, the Hawkeye computer system with its kind of 3D cameras works out whether the line call was correct or not. When the challenge is made, 40% of the time, the line judge is wrong. So my conclusion was that from that is that, you know, line judges are wrong a surprising amount of the time. Therefore, it was right for your man to step up and
did John
complain.
McEnroe actually have anything to do with this study?
Not really.
I'm just listening to what you just said.
Not as such, especially since, you know, of course, Hawkeye didn't exist back in the glory days of the centre court when he was but a young nymph.
He was just a shameless picture story, wasn't it, for you lot? That's what it was.
Well, look,
was this another
that,
one of those testosterone-fueled mistakes or something?
It was. Of course, it was a shameless picture story, but it also allowed me to get the words "you cannot be serious" into my copy. I actually had the words "you are the pits of the world" in there as well, but they cut that out for some reason.
Well, James, you and your testosterone can take a break now. Thanks very much for all of that. You can read more about all of these stories at guardian.co.uk/science. Treating infertile couples by making, quote, artificial sperm and eggs from other cells will be possible within 5 to 15 years. That's according to an international group of scientists, science funders and policymakers. The technology could also potentially allow gay and lesbian couples to have children, as well as making so-called designer babies more easy to produce and permit postmenopausal women to have children. But what about the ethics of making sperm and eggs from stem cells? Our ever-intrepid reporter James went to find out more.
I'm Dr. Deborah Matthews. I am the Assistant Director for Science Programs in the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics in Baltimore, Maryland, USA, and a member of the steering committee of the Hingston Group. The Hingston Group is an international consortium of scientists, ethicists, policymakers, lawyers who are interested in fostering scientifically and ethically defensible research in the area of stem cell science. Our most recent project is on pluripotent stem cell-derived gametes, which is a mouthful, which basically means using stem cells of various sorts to derive egg and sperm, as opposed to neurons or muscle cells, for example. We aren't keen on the term synthetic or artificial because if you are able to succeed in deriving gametes or deriving sperm and eggs, which we think will be possible, then they would be able to successfully make an embryo, and that certainly wouldn't be an artificial embryo. And any child that may result after a clinical treatment wouldn't be an artificial child. They would be a real child. So the difference with the sorts of gametes that we're talking about are they aren't grown within a body, but rather are grown in the lab.
So clinical applications are still some way off at the moment, and the sort of things we'd be perhaps be talking about is a man who's infertile and can't produce his own sperm, you could perhaps use one of his skin cells and then create sperm from that. That's the sort of thing we'd be talking about, I suppose.
Yes, but that is quite a way away. What the group concluded is that we're going to get, first of all, we certainly think that we are going to be able to do this. We are going to be able to take pluripotent stem cells and derive eggs and sperm, and that we'll be able to do this in whole or in part within the next 5 or 15 years. We're certainly on our way to that, but not there yet. And any clinical applications wouldn't, of course, come until after we were sure that what we were getting were real functional eggs and sperm.
This topic always brings up the idea that homosexual couples might be able to have children, so perhaps you might be able to produce sperm from a woman or eggs from a man. You seem to be, or the group seem to be fairly skeptical that this could actually happen. Why is that?
Yeah. From a scientific point of view, it is going to be very difficult to go from a cell that is chromosomally male, so an XY cell, to an egg. And it's going to be even more difficult, if not impossible, as we say in the document, to go from an XX cell, which is a female cell, to a sperm. And that's because while we all have most of the chromosomes in common, men have an X and a Y, and women have two X's. And there's information on the sex-specific chromosomes, the X and the Y, that's necessary to drive eggs and sperm. So in particular, in female cells or XX cells, where you lack the Y altogether, you lack the genetic information necessary to tell the cell how to become a sperm.
What other ethical objections are there?
If you're talking about, in particular, iPS cells, so induced pluripotent cells, or taking a skin cell, de-differentiating it into a stem cell, and then using that to make eggs and sperm, there is the possibility of doing genetic modification on those cells. So you make a genetic modification in the stem cell line, and then you derive eggs and sperm that have that particular genetic change that you've made. Some of these changes may feel not so bad, like correcting, for example, the sickle cell mutation or cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease. But other genetic modifications, such as trying to enhance, make someone taller or make someone smarter, these are very complex things that would require many, many changes, or inducing a mutation that would make any resulting child deaf, which has been an issue here in the UK. Those are also ways that you could go with that genetic modification. So genetic modification as a tool in this area, stem cell-derived gametes, you may be able to do things that people won't object as much to, but you would also then be able to do things that many people would object to.
Deborah Matthews there from Johns Hopkins University. You can read more about this story on guardian.co.uk/science. Now then, here's another extract from the Guardian Science Course, read to you by Nell Bowes. This is Tim Radford's take on the question of life itself.
Life looks increasingly like a chemical experiment that took over the laboratory. All living things turn to dust and ashes when they die, or, to put it another way, to constituent atoms and molecules of hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, phosphorus, and so on. But in another sense, living things do not die. They begin again, from a tiny cell, and scavenge the dust, the air and water, to find the elements necessary to fashion an aspidistra, an elephant, or an attorney general, using only the raw materials to hand, and energy from a thermonuclear reactor, 93 million miles away. The freshly minted self-replicating organism then grows up, grows old, and melts away, but not before imparting a fragment of itself to generate yet another copy. Not an identical copy. The process is visible and transparent. It's everywhere on the planet, but it is ultimately mysterious. It has been going on for at least 3.5 billion years, but researchers may never satisfactorily explain how it ever got started.
Science Weekly.
Let's return again to our interview with Professor Colin Blakemore. In case we didn't stress the point before, Professor Blakemore is one of the UK's, if not the world's, leading medical researchers. So what keeps him up at night with worry? What are the big scientific and technological challenges that face the UK? Here's his rundown.
Well, first of all, I think one of the biggest questions is how can we more effectively use science to guarantee the future of our economy? We just haven't been. We've been brilliant at science in the past. You know, we punch above our weight, the phrase goes. But we haven't done a good job of turning that into innovation and into huge wealth. We're notoriously bad at investing in R&D in industry. I mean, linking those two things. And lots of clever people are giving a lot of thought to that. But in terms of the practical things to be addressed by science, well, for the UK, they're much the same as the rest of the world. I mean, what are we going to do about energy supply? And I put that ahead of climate change, because the real issue is how are we going to provide energy? And, of course, you know, not carbon-based energy, preferably, for the world. How are we going to get a grip on the effects of the population and its explosion. I mean, that's, to my mind, still at the root of all the problems that we're looking at, the problems of disease and its transmission, problem of other forms of infectious disease, the problems of food supply and water supply, the problems of climate change driven by CO2 production, driven by the relentless demand for energy consumption. It all has to do with population. But that seems to have got sidelined somehow. We just sort of accepted that we failed there. Our population's doubled in my lifetime.
Is there anything practically that we can do about population? You know, are there, or is it?
It is the biggest challenge to one of the most challenging areas of science that there is, and that is to understand human behavior. You know, we talk about behavior change. That'll be the solution to the obesity problem, the, you know, and the diabetes and everything that follows that. That'll be the solution to a problem with heart disease. That'll be a solution to, you know, all kinds of difficulties. It is a matter of knowing how we, as sometimes intelligent, often not, organisms, choose to regulate our lives, including how we choose to reproduce.
James Randerson there asking the questions to Professor Colin Blakemore. Just a reminder for everyone that the full interview is available as this week's Science Extra on the website. You can hear Professor Blakemore's thoughts on science versus religion, including the very public spat between Robert Winston and Richard Dawkins. You can hear what he thinks about drug classification and also how he believes that science should be used when making laws. And that's us done for another week. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to everything we've discussed in the show. Don't forget, too, that the Guardian Science course starts next Saturday with a new booklet accompanying your fantastically well-priced 80 pence newspaper every single day, crammed with thoughts and opinions like this.
Imagine if a god had created the universe and he had said, "I'm going to insert a fixed amount of energy into this universe of mine. I will let stars form and explode, and planets move in their orbits, and I will have people create great cities, and there will be battles that destroy those cities, and then I'll let the survivors create new civilizations. There will be fires and horses and oxen pulling carts. There will be coal and steam engines and factories and even mighty locomotives and iPhones. Yet throughout the whole sequence, even though the types of energy that people see will change, even though sometimes the energy will appear as the heat of a human or animal muscle, and sometimes it will appear as the gushing of waterfalls or the explosions of volcanoes, despite all those variations, the total amount of energy will remain the same. The amount I create at the beginning will not change. There will be not one millionth part less than what was there at the start." Expressed like this, it sounds like the sheerest mumbo-jumbo. Like something that Yoda mysteriously speak would in Star Wars. Or like the popular superstitions that would drive Richard Dawkins into an apoplexy. What's extraordinary, though, is that it's true. Although the God part is contestable.
Nell Bose there, reading David Badanis' exaltation on energy. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.